I don't know who your heroines are, who are the women you look up to, whether they're fictional characters or in movies or in real life. Maybe it's Eliza Bennett. Do you know who Eliza Bennett is? For those of you who watched Pride and Prejudice or read the books, remember Eliza Bennett? Okay, no Pride and Prejudice fans, that's meaningless. Well, what about this one? Captain Marvel. Do you know Captain Marvel? The latest incarnation of Captain Marvel, it's a girl. Right, Captain Marvel, one of the... No? All right. What about Lagatha? Has anybody seen this Viking series? All right. Okay, we're not doing well here. does anybody watch or read Outlander? Is Claire your hero? All right. A few of you? Some of you? None? All right, what about real life people? What about real life people? What about Elise Perry? Is she your hero? You know who she is? One of Australia's great sports persons. Fantastic cricketer. What about someone historic like Catherine Booth? Would she be a hero, someone you look up to? She's an extraordinary woman, I think, Catherine Booth. Wouldn't have the Salvation Army without her. I really think, we're talking today about Mary Magdalene, right? And I think she's one of my heroes. She's definitely one of those people that when I do get to heaven on that day of rejoicing, I'll ask, where's Mary? Like, I want to catch up because I want to ask her some questions because she's a very unique figure. And sometimes when we don't read the gospel beginning to end, we kind of miss out on, she's a name we know, but we kind of miss out on how important she actually is and the significance of her story. And I know that this is a story that we'd normally teach at Easter. But kind of in the Easter story, so we're focused on Jesus and the resurrection, we kind of miss who Mary was and the significance of this story. And it is a very, very significant story, what happens here. So we didn't read all of this scene. It actually starts a few verses before the verses that Bruce read to us. So it starts on early Sunday morning on that first Easter, and Mary Magdalene, she loves Jesus, right? And so she goes to the tomb, and she is the one who sees that the tomb is empty, and she goes back and she gets the male disciples, and a couple of them race to the tomb and they outrun her, and Peter is one of them, and the other disciple outruns Peter, and they get to the tomb, the empty tomb, and then they run away again. Right, there's a lot of running in this story, but Mary Magdalene stays because she wants to find Jesus. She wants to find Jesus. And she says, where is he? And when she sees Jesus, and she doesn't realise it is Jesus, right? Because she thinks he's dead. I don't know if you've ever done that thing where you've seen someone out of context and it's someone you know, but you don't know who they were. It happened to me years ago when the Commonwealth Games had just been on TV. I remember when I was a young guy in Brisbane and I saw this girl sitting over there. And I thought, oh, I know that girl. Now, where do I know her from? And I was just about to walk up to her and say, oh, start chatting, you know, and you? And somebody said, oh, there's Hayley Lewis. Because I'd been used to seeing her swimming on TV, it was a face I knew, but it was out of context, right? So Mary didn't expect Jesus. And she thinks at first that he's the gardener, which is very appropriate in our garden series. Jesus says, why are you crying? And we know that Mary has looked away again, right? She's not really paying attention to who he is. And she says, where have you taken him? Tell me and I will get him. See, Mary's a woman of action. She's a decisive person. She acts. When she sees something that needs a response, she acts. Where have you taken him? I will go and get him. I will. I will go and get him. And then Jesus says her name. He says, Mary. And she realises who it is. And she says, Rabboni, in Aramaic, which means teacher. And probably she hugs him, because he then says to her, don't hold on to me, all right? Don't hold on to me. Kind of, and maybe, it's okay, I'm not going yet, or he starts to tell her that he's going to go soon. And then he says to her, go and tell the disciples that I'll be ascending to the Father, my Father, and your Father, my God and your God. This is the very first time that Jesus has used this language, right? So something significant is taking place here. Jesus has never spoken like this before. He's always said, I must do the will of my Father. I must do the will of him who sent me, particularly in John's Gospel. We hear those words. So this is something significant that's happening. My God and your God. And so then Mary goes to the male disciples and the other disciples. And she says, I have seen the Lord. I have seen the Lord. And she tells them what Jesus has said to her. The significance of this story is that Mary is the very first person to bear witness to the resurrection. The very first person to bear witness to her risen Lord. And when we read this story, I don't know about you, but it sounds like a real story. But sometimes when we read stories, sometimes they're told third hand and we don't know the detail. But there's kind of this level of detail of who's looking at whom and how fiercely she's crying. Because the witness to this story is Mary, right? The men aren't there. We know that. We've been told that they've gone. And it's Mary on her own. So this is a story that Mary has told the others. She is the witness to this story. And in it, we sense her very real grief and a very real love for Jesus. Now, Mary's background was, it's been quite abused by the church, really, but Mary's background was that she'd been healed by Jesus. And Luke's gospel tells us that Mary, along with several other women, went with Jesus as disciples and cared for him out of their own means. So they supported him financially, provided for him and the other disciples. And we know that Luke tells us that she'd been healed of seven spirits. We don't really know what that means. Seven in the ancient world was a number of completion. So it might be that she was totally overwhelmed by spirits. We don't know why it mattered that there was seven. But she had significant healing at Jesus' hands. So we can imagine her, this woman who has borne perhaps psychological and emotional wounds from the spirits, whatever it was, that had taken possession of her, whatever the shape it had. And she'd been healed by Jesus, and she'd loved him, and she'd followed him, and she supported him. And when she had died, she was overwhelmed by grief, and she had to do something. She was a woman of action. Now, she's a really interesting person, Mary. She's the most named non-family member of Jesus. Whenever she and the other women, their names are listed, it's always her name that is listed first in the Gospels. In fact, she's one of the three most named disciples. Now, do you know who the top three were? Have a guess who you think the top one might be. Who's the most named disciple? Peter. All right, good job. All right, it was Peter. He's the most named disciple. It wasn't James and John. It was Judas and Mary. Judas for very different reasons to Peter, you understand. All right? But Mary is in the top three of the most named disciples. We also need to remind ourselves that, what this story tells us really is that she was an important figure in the church. Lots of recent studies of the particularly the Gospels have been wrestling with this issue of the eyewitnesses to these stories and how we can kind of infer when we read the Gospels that this is an account of an eyewitness. Or is ascribed to an eyewitness. And what lots of scholars say these days is that when the gospel writers give names, they give names because the people who are hearing the story know their names. So just like we would tell a story, if I was telling a story to you about someone you knew, I would name them. All right? If I was telling you a story about people you didn't know, the names don't matter quite so much. All right? But if it's a story about someone you knew, we name them. And Mary's named all the time. And we know from this story that she's the witness to it. So she's a witness, part of the gospel record. So in a sense, what John has recorded here is Mary's story told by Mary. Okay? So that matters. The other thing to take note of is that she is not a fallen woman. I just wanted to make that clear. Mary Magdalene is not a fallen woman. She is, in fact, the patron saint of fallen women. But that's because a very otherwise very good man made a terrible mistake. His name was Pope Gregory. And he was a good bloke who reformed the priesthood, did all sorts of nice things in the Catholic Church. But in 581, he conflated three women in the New Testament. That is, he merged them and saw them as one. And that was Mary Magdalene, Mary who was the sister of Martha, and the woman who'd wept on Jesus' feet and washed them with her hair, who we know was a full-on woman. So ever since, from 581, it's been told, and you probably get this sense, wasn't it, that Mary Magdalene was a fallen woman. We kind of have that idea in our heads. And just by the by, do you know when the Catholic Church corrected that mistake? They corrected it in 1969, all right? Which was kind of a long time for a mistake like that to hang around. And you remember, those were the days, back in the day, well, it still is actually, if the Pope says something, it's gospel, all right? So in popular culture, if you've seen any, there's been recent movies about her, or even if you remember back to something like Jesus Christ Superstar, the song that Mary Magdalene sings, she says, I don't know how to, I've known so many men before, right? That's the picture we have of her, but she wasn't. She wasn't a fallen woman. It seems like she was an independently wealthy woman. She was a woman of action. She was a woman who knew and loved Jesus, all right? And Jesus chose her. He chose her to be the first witness to his resurrection. Because it's not an accident, right? He could have appeared to Peter and John, but he didn't. It was after they'd gone, he appeared to Mary. And we need to think that that matters, that Jesus' first appearance is to Mary. And she's an important person. She was an important disciple, an important follower of Jesus. And she's important in our story here. Because it highlights several things for us that we need to pay attention to. The first thing is that the witness of women mattered. Now, in Jewish culture at that time, women couldn't bear witness to anything. And in the courts, in fact, it had to be two men who gave witness to something. But here is a single woman. And a single woman, Jesus was the first witness, and Jesus said to her, as my witness implied, go and tell. Jesus chose Mary, and it is significant. It was for John, that's why he tells this story, right? It was significant for John. She was the first witness to the empty tomb. She was the first apostle. In fact, one of her titles in the church is the apostle to the apostles. She's the first messenger to the messengers. N.T. Wright, who's a New Testament scholar, would say that we need to pay attention to this story, because here in this story, given by Jesus, is the right for women to preach the gospel. The very first preacher was a woman. This is an important story. Now, we're part of a movement that values women preaching, don't we? I hope we do, that we value women preaching. But in this day and age, it is possible right here in Sydney in 2020 that you could go to congregations where no woman has ever preached and no woman would be allowed to preach. And we would reject that. And we reject that not because William said, my best men are women, or Catherine was bossy and said, William, I'll have a word. There's a scriptural mandate for this. The very first witness to the gospel, to the risen Christ, was a woman. And that story matters. Jesus makes no distinction between her and the male disciples. He chooses her in this instance over someone like Peter, who in many other cases was the first choice disciple. The other thing we need to note here, and what's so lovely in this story, is how it's a story driven by her love for him, I think. Her great grief is an expression of her love for him, isn't it? And her response to him is a response of recognition and love, to truly see Jesus and to know herself in relation to him. He mattered, Jesus mattered to her. And to know that he knew her, that he said her name, mattered a lot to her. It's a kind of poignant story, full of meaning. And in her grief and loss, of course, at first she saw a gardener. And we would say, no, she didn't see a gardener. But in a sense, she did. There's a symbolism in this story, right? We talked about the Garden of Eden. The first Adam, whose failure led to a fallen humankind. And in this garden, Jesus, the new Adam, is the beginning of the new story of the redemption of humankind. It begins in this garden. I don't think she was thinking about that at the time. She wasn't properly probably stopping to think through all the theological and symbolic implications of what was happening. What she saw was her teacher and her healer and her friend, and he was her Lord. He was her Lord. And he was the Lord that she followed. And she was a woman of action, and she was a decisive person. And in that moment, Jesus speaks to her, and it's like something has changed. Those words where he says, "My God and your God, I must ascend to my God and your God, my Father and your Father." Something has changed in the whole economy of salvation. It's the beginning, really, of the disciples taking up their mantle to minister, taking up their mantle to preach the good news. Perhaps that's what Jesus, "Don't hold on to me," really meant. It's up to you now, Mary. It's up to you. Yes, my spirit will always be with you. Yes, my memory will always be in your heart. That will never change. But this is the beginning of the end for my time, my physical time here on earth. Now, Mary probably wasn't thinking all that through either. But she knows what she knows, and she knows that Jesus is alive. She knows that Jesus is alive and her world has changed, and that she's the first witness to the resurrection, the turning point of history. It really was the greatest day in history. Jesus is alive. "I know, I feel," she might have said. "Jesus lives and loves me still." I did take those words from a song, you know that, don't you? A Charles Wesley song. But Mary would have sung it if she could sing in English. I don't know what the Aramaic translation is. "Jesus lives, I know, I feel. Jesus lives and loves me still." She would have said that. And ever since, Christians really have been singing Mary's response, because the first sermon is really the only sermon. Like, we add lots of bits onto it, you know, but the first sermon is the fact that he's risen. He's risen. He's the risen Lord. He's alive and he lives in me. "He lives, he lives. Christ Jesus lives today." They could have been her words, couldn't they, when she got to those disciples? It's a great chorus. I'll do a Bruce. "He lives, he lives. Christ Jesus lives today. He walks with me and he talks with me along life's narrow way. He lives, he lives. Salvation to impart. You ask me how I know he lives. He lives within my heart." See, I knew you'd do it. I knew you'd do it. We tried in 9:30. Not so many people responded. You sang beautifully, I will say that. Mary would have sung that too, wouldn't she? She'd sing that chorus. "He lives, he lives. Christ Jesus lives today." She would have said that. And then Jesus gives her her mission as the first preacher, as the apostle to the apostles. "Go and tell them," the gathered disciples, "go and tell them that I'm alive. Go and tell them what I've said to you." So when Jesus entrusts the telling to her, right? He doesn't say, "I'm going to go there and tell them myself." "I trust you. You go and tell them." The apostle to the apostles, the very first missioner, the very first preacher, the very first sermon. The very first sermon, Christian sermon, was not in Acts, right, with Peter. It was Mary. In this garden of joy, Mary cries out. And if the cry of humanity's fall was God saying to Adam, "What have you done?" the cry of our lifting up is Mary's. "I have seen the Lord," is what she says. "I have seen the Lord." And it is personal. It is universal in its implications, but it is particular. It is cosmic, but it is personal. A personal relationship is at the heart of this story of Mary, a disciple of Jesus who loved Jesus with all her heart. And it is for us too. You'd probably remember in the 90s when there was a big shift in praise and worship, and lots of new worship songs, contemporary worship songs, started to be written. And it began what some would later call the worship wars, right? As people wrestle with this, you know, what songs do we sing? The songs we've always known, or these new songs. And one of the things that people used to say unwisely, I think, and I'm sure none of you ever said it, was that all these new songs, they're all about me. You know, they're all about me. They're just self-focused. Unless you thought about it for two or three more minutes, and then you thought about all the songs that you loved from the songbook, which are always about me and I, in the first person singular. I have no claim on grace. I have no right to plead. I stand before my Maker's face, condemned in thought and deed. But since there died a lamb who guiltless my sin bore, I lay fast hold on Jesus' name, and sin is mine no more. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. Just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me. They're all me songs, aren't they? At the heart of this Jesus story is a personal relationship with Jesus. It is first person singular, right? It is personal. We know that. You love Jesus on your own. There's no such thing as a collective love for Jesus. It's personal. But that doesn't mean it's private, you see. It's not a secret that we keep to ourselves. Yes, it's personal, but it's not just for us alone. When you get fantastic personal news, and yes, it's personal, but you want to tell someone. What's the first thing you do? I know what you kids do. If you hear some great personal news and you're on Instagram, aren't you? Straight away, Snapchat, you're tweeting, aren't you? Facebook, maybe? Or maybe you ring someone and tell them, I've got great news. I've heard great news to tell them. When we have a great personal news, we want to tell somebody. You want to tell somebody. And I think even more so when Jesus tells us that we have to tell somebody. All right? That's what he says to Mary. Go and tell them, Mary. Right? You've seen me. You've heard what I said. Go and tell them, Mary. And so Mary went and preached. I've seen the Lord. Seen him. Heard him. I've seen the Lord. I've seen him, heard him, felt his presence in worship. I've seen him, felt him and heard him in the faithful prayers of the church. I've seen him and felt him and heard him in the generous, loving action of God's people. Mary told the gathered disciples, I've seen the Lord. It is the mark of the disciple and the apostle, the messenger of the good news. It was Paul's defense when he was under attack in the church at Corinth. He wrote to them, have I not seen the Lord? I'm an apostle. Have I not seen the Lord? That's what it means to be God's messenger. See, at its heart, preaching is not to be a teacher. It's not to be a polished public speaker. It's not even to prepare sermons. At the heart of the matter, preaching is to be a messenger. It is to be a storyteller, to tell over and over again the story of God's love for us. And he's longing to save us and to restore us. Sometimes we imagine it's a gift for a few, but it's not the case. It's the call for all of us. We're messengers of this good news. We're all apostles. It's a job for all of us. I've seen the Lord. I've encountered Jesus. He's alive in my heart. I know him and love him. That's our message. That's it. Jesus is alive in us. Let's never stop telling the world. Now, I know that lots of you have done this for many years. All right, you've told your friends and your neighbours and your children and your grandchildren, your nephews and your nieces and your cousins, you've told them this story. You wanted them to know it. But it never stops this job, you see. It never stops this job. Jesus calls us to tell people in our words and in our actions. I want us to sing a lovely song. I love this tune, Aurelia. I love these words. They say, O Jesus, I've promised to serve thee to the end. Be thou forever near me, my master and my friend. This is a song, it's a personal song of love for Jesus, responding to his call on our hearts and lives. We're going to sing this together. The band's going to join us for some of the verses as well, but I wanted to give them an opportunity to sing these beautiful, beautiful words. So let's sing this song as a response to God. Let's bow our hearts before him. Think back to that moment in our garden, our metaphorical garden, when we met Jesus, when we knew he was alive in us. And he'd called us. He called us to share that good news. Thank him for every step along the way. Look forward to every step that lies ahead as we sing this song together.